We are going to move on to our second agenda item, which is the audit implications of IFRS financial statements and SEC filings. There's a couple of new faces here at the table I'd just like to introduce. Julie Earhart, who's a deputy chief accountant at the SEC over international matters, is joining us for this discussion. Welcome, Julie. And to lead us in this discussion are Greg Skates, deputy chief auditor, and Brian Degano, who is our newest associate chief auditor, recently joined the staff from Deloitte. Brian was in the fraud and forensic area, and he also spent a couple of years at the FASB as a professional fellow, and Brian's here to help lead us through this discussion this morning, so I turn it over to you two. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. As you're aware, the SEC recently issued a proposed rule change and a concept release related to financial statements prepared in accordance with the International Financial Reporting Standards, or commonly referred to as IFRS. Under the proposal release, foreign private issuers that prepare their financial statements in accordance with these International Financial Reporting Standards, as published by the International Accounting Standards Board, or IASB, would no longer be required to reconcile to U.S. GAAP. The concept release seeks feedback on whether the SEC would permit, should permit U.S. companies to prepare their financial statements in accordance with the International Financial Reporting Standards. Currently, foreign private issuers are required to reconcile their financial statements to U.S. GAAP. To address quality control concerns related to foreign associated firms that audit their filings, the AICPA's SEC practice section back in 1999 issued guidance in a document we commonly refer to as Appendix K. Appendix K sought to enhance the quality of SEC filings by seeking to involve individuals knowledgeable about U.S. accounting, auditing, and independent standards with SEC filings audited by these foreign associated firms. The PCAOB, as you're aware, adopted the Appendix K as part of our interim quality control standards. As was alluded to this morning in our discussion, the European Union has been pushing towards the companies in the European Union to adopt IFRS in the preparation of financial statements. In conjunction with that, some of the auditing firms have created global offices to consult on IFRS issues and the implementation of those standards. These global offices, in some cases, perform these reviews that are noted in Appendix K. This brings me to my first series of questions, the first question being, to what extent does Appendix K enhance the effectiveness of the audit performed on the financial statements of foreign private issuers? Also, have the auditing procedures applied to U.S. GAAP reconciliation pursuant to Appendix K resulted in increased consistency in the application of IFRS by foreign private issuers? I'll be glad to take comments now from the members of the SAG on this first series of questions. Sam Ranzillo.
Let me try to address this question. I think your sub-question is actually a misnomer. And I think that the question ought to read, have the auditing procedures applied to the U.S. GAAP reconciliation? I don't think it actually relates to the auditing procedures applied, but whether, I think your question is getting more to the point of, does the U.S. GAAP reconciliation itself result in a more consistent application of IFRS? And I think the answer to that is yes. I think that that is accepted, that the existence of the U.S. GAAP reconciliation does, to some extent, affect one's application of IFRS. And I will say that from my own viewpoint, while I think that that is true, I also don't believe that's a compelling reason to keep the U.S. GAAP reconciliation. As it relates to Appendix K, I think that Appendix K and the procedures as currently constituted under Appendix K does improve the effectiveness of the U.S. GAAP reconciliation. I mean, I believe that the majority, the focus of Appendix K is, as you noted, Greg, in several different areas. But it does improve, it does affect the quality of the reconciliation to U.S. GAAP. That said, and consistent with my firm's and my own views in our comment letter on the elimination of the U.S. GAAP reconciliation, we think that in a world where there was no U.S. GAAP reconciliation, that it doesn't make sense, that Appendix K no longer makes sense in the world that we live in today. It's very different than the world we lived in 1999. And when you strip out a U.S. GAAP reconciliation, there is, in my mind, fails to be a compelling case any longer to have an Appendix K filing reviewer. Now, we still support the inspection procedures in Appendix K, even in a world without U.S. GAAP reconciliation. But where you strip out the U.S. GAAP reconciliation, I'm not sure that Appendix K makes sense any longer.
Upkeepers?
Thank you, Greg. I do remember 1999. I remember working with colleagues in the firms creating Appendix K in the first place, and I think it might be instructive to just mention a couple bits of background. I think the two things that were compelling at the time were the desire, the need to try and promote greater consistency within the network firms, the firms that have global reach, your firm in Chile or your firm in, pick a country, doing a U.S. gas gap audit, doing a U.S. gas audit on U.S. GAAP financial statements, either reconciled or prepared in accordance with U.S. GAAP. I think there were concerns that the level and depth of knowledge around the globe on these matters was often limited in large part to U.S. expats who might be assigned, to various countries. I think further, the staff of the SEC was very keen on trying to get confident that an audit report signed by, even though it may be a member firm, let's say our network, the letterhead is still, Bogota or wherever it is, that the firms have the requisite qualifications. And at the time, I think, we sort of came together with this idea of a file reviewer. And, as applied in practice, some of the firms have used expats who are in country and therefore knowledgeable. Others perhaps have used a U.S.-based reviewer, and others still have other approaches to it. But to Sam's point, I think that, we shouldn't assume that file review, gets down into the weeds on specific audit procedures so much as looks at the reconciliation, queries the engagement team to get confident and comfortable about their knowledge. And in the last 10 years, there's been a sea change in the ability and capability of partners in almost all geographies now, as the number of foreign filers has grown. And I think that if you try and reduce it to its essence, a lot of the things came out in terms of questions about the U.S. GAAP reconciliation. So I'm agreeing with Sam that if that reconciliation is no longer part and parcel of the filing in question, pursuant to changes the SEC might make, I'm just not sure that you get as much out of that as we might have 10 years ago. Having said that, I do think, to your basic question, I think it has helped promote consistency in audits, and I think it's taken places where, if for whatever reason it was, it might have been a little subpar, it was a good mechanism to ferret that out and make improvements. But, you know, to suggest that because of that, audit quality overall has risen dramatically, I think, is a vast overstatement.
Christy Wood.
On the issue of reconciliation, there are a couple of points I want to make. The first is that the Audit and Accounting Committee of the ICGN, of which I am chair, did not support reconciliation, and the committee could not decide. And so the fact that the letter doesn't support that is not necessarily clear in the letter, and the letter is not necessarily representative of the views of the committee. And so that's point number one. Second point that I think is important is that to the extent that there is valuable information for investors in Appendix K, I think that it would be unfortunate to lose it. And so in the sense that there is that it is helpful and that there's information there, we would want to have you supportive.
Damon Silvers.
Yeah, thank you. Perhaps just to sort of echo in some more detail what Christy just said, although, to be honest with you, I couldn't quite follow the politics of the ICGN and what you said.
But it's I can't not either sometimes.
Probably not that relevant. The Appendix K has this very specific sort of application to a regime in which a gap reconciliation occurs. We move to a regime in which no such reconciliation occurs, in which an IFRS based financial statement is the information is the audited financial statement that appears in the U.S. market. That circumstance would seem to very much increase the importance and relevance of some oversight of the audit process that attests to the accuracy of that financial statement. Even more so, I think, because, and I may misunderstand these things, and so someone will correct me, but that the relationship really between the U.S.-based firm and its foreign affiliates is a pretty close one, and that we're not asking something radical here, that there be some oversight on the part of what is effectively, and again, this may not be politically correct to say this, but what is effectively apparent over a subsidiary, and that we have processes to ensure that these new IFRS-based financial statements are reliable. That would seem to suggest that we need to make some changes to Appendix K, but that effectively, as Christy said, that the value of it, the value of the sort of home office oversight here, and the obligation to exercise that oversight in relation to IFRS statements is preserved. I think that's where the information is that's useful here. And what we would seem to be saying is that out there in the world generally, there are comparable audit oversight bodies and comparable audit oversight regimes so that we don't need to worry about it. I don't think most investors think that's true, that as a general matter in all countries in the world where foreign private issuers come to the United States, that all is well and we can just assume that they've got it under control.
Vin Coleman.
Well, Damon, I'm not sure I'll correct you, but I do think we should expand maybe the knowledge and the history of Appendix K a little bit where Bob and Sam were going. Because I think that, I mean, the statement, I just want to be careful. Appendix K does not give more information to an investor. They are additional audit procedures that were put in place back in 1999 to deal with some very specific risks. There have been a number of changes since 1999 that mitigate those risks, particularly around the auditing and the independence. So that when you move to the accounting, and I want to come back, Damon, to you, the point you just made, when you say oversight of the audit process, there are procedures now in place of the oversight of the audit process around the world that were not there back in 1999. So it's just we're in a very, very different world on the auditing. I want to clarify on the accounting. When you move to the, where you say, who understands IFRS? So let's go back. I just want to clarify at least recommendation. Removing Appendix K makes a lot of sense to the extent there is no U.S. GAAP in a filing. So if the reconciliation goes away, there's also foreign private issuers today who file with respect to U.S. GAAP primary financial statements. To the extent that that is continuing to happen, leaving Appendix K for that set of filings continues to make a lot of sense. To the extent that you no longer have U.S. GAAP and you're under IFRS, the notion that someone here in the United States understands IFRS better than perhaps someone in the U.K. or in Europe who has adopted IFRS for the last couple years, I think is an interesting notion, because we have to go back and say, what is Appendix K? It's not more information to an investor. It is, in essence, a third review. Right, so you have a primary partner. You now have the quality standards that we have been talking about with respect to somebody who is skilled to make sure that that's done. And now Appendix K is now a review of the accounting by yet a third person. It was adopted because perhaps there were people around the world down in Chile who didn't understand U.S. GAAP. It got very complicated. And it was to make sure that expertise was around the world and that added procedure and that added cost. When you move into the world of IFRS, there certainly needs to be controls with the risk statement that you talked about, but the skill set is not as different. All right, there's going to be a new paradigm. The new paradigm is how Sam talked about it, where we now have a global organization where we need to look at the consistency of the implementation of IFRS around the world. It's a different challenge, and it's a different quality control procedure that needs to be put in place. Right? It's just different. And the PCAOB does look at the overall quality controls and procedures of the firm. So I just think that we're moving into a different world, and there needs to be a different mechanism to control the risk that you suggested.
Bob Kippers.
Vin, I think, was more articulate than I planned to be, so those are basic points. I did want to correct the record. I do know that Bogota is not in Chile, just in case anybody picked up on that. I do think that the, take Vin's point just a step further. Let's say you had a U.S. company filing in the U.K. and that we, in a different world where U.S. GAAP was accepted in the U.K., having a file reviewer in London review our U.S. GAAP financials for quality purposes doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, just as I would not be the best file reviewer on an IFRS-based financial statement, because I wasn't steeped and trained in IFRS the way many of the folks in London can do today. So I think that the key is the accounting. And in a reconciliation, what you're always looking for is understatement, because I'm trying to translate from, whatever gap, French gap, to U.S., and you're worried about people missing reconciling items. I mean, it's rare that you would find, unnecessary reconciling items. It's do you have all the differences? Can a U.S. investor figure out where that reconciliation gets you down to the net in U.S. GAAP terms? So I still think there's legitimacy to the point that once, if U.S. GAAP remains a possibility for a filer, and we have a bunch of foreign clients that use U.S. GAAP today, so they don't reconcile, then I think that requirement remains. There's efficacy to it, and I think it would continue to improve quality.
Cynthia Richardson.
It seems to me that these set of questions in Schedule K or Appendix K is related to the other topics that will be discussed of if the SEC does pass a rule to permit U.S. companies to elect to use IFRS as opposed to U.S. GAAP. Because reconciliation at this point in time provides additional information to investors, because there are material differences that exist between IFRS and U.S. GAAP. And to the extent that the future holds that U.S. companies can elect to use IFRS, at least during the transition period, until accountants and staff here truly are well-versed technically in IFRS, and the curriculum in the schools gets changed for training future accountants, that does provide important information so that investors can understand more fully what the differences are so they can interpret the results accurately. So maybe Schedule K needs to be revised as opposed to eliminated if reconciliation is eliminated for foreign companies.
Greg, if I might just make a comment, maybe add to the question a little bit. Appendix K certainly does deal with the accounting and with a gap, U.S. gap, whether it be in a reconciliation or other form. But it also deals with other matters such as auditing. There are some limited procedures directed towards knowledge of auditing and other regulatory matters. So I'd be interested to hear some comment as it relates to those aspects of Appendix K that deal with these other things as well.
You can't see the tent car. Is that Sam? Is that yours or Bob Tarolo? All right. Sam Ranzilla.
Once again, I think it's important to clarify that Appendix K is not a part of the argument of domestic registrants going to IFRS. Those are two very different situations, and I just think it's important that we understand that Appendix K deals with a foreign private issuer only, and does not go to the concept release that the SEC has issued with respect to domestic registrants going to IFRS. Appendix K is outside of that. To maybe address Tom's points on that, Appendix K does go more than just to the U.S. GAAP reconciliation and does address the auditing and the independence standards. Again, from our perspective in looking at our practice, a lot has changed since 1999 with respect to auditing standards and with respect to independence. First, the fact that we're here today, the PCAOB and the registration and inspection process was not there in 1999. Secondly, AS5 and the whole integrated audit methodology that the largest firms apply across the globe. Third, back in 1999, the SEC would accept auditors' reports that said, we have conducted our audit in accordance with, to stay with Bob's tone, Chilean GAAP, which we believe is substantially the equivalent of U.S. GAAP. U.S. GAAP back then was the state of art because it was prior to PCAOB standards. Since 2000, the SEC, or 2001, the SEC has removed the ability of foreign auditors to state that we've done an audit in accordance with our GAAP, and we believe that's substantially equivalent and has required an affirmative statement that it's been in accordance with either U.S. GAAP or PCAOB auditing standards. And back at the time that Appendix K was written, that discussion around auditing standards was it really equivalent? Now there is a positive assertion that it's been applied in accordance with today PCAOB standards. I think that's several very significant changes in the landscape as it relates to foreign auditors, and in our view causes us to believe that in a world where there is no U.S. GAAP reconciliation, it's hard to justify continued the other elements of Appendix K. And I guess I would analogize it to another situation, and again, going back to the point in a world where IFRS is the primary financials, there's no U.S. GAAP reconciliation. Think about what you're asking, what would you be asking that filing reviewer to do? And think of it in the context of what if you asked an inspector at the PCAOB to go do an inspection but don't worry about the gap. Just go deal with the auditing standards around but just don't worry about how they've applied the accounting principles. I don't know how you do that. And that's in essence what you might be asking a filing reviewer to do. And is that something where they can be both effective and efficient in a world where they're not addressing the application of the accounting principles?
Dick Dietrich?
Let me begin with an apology because I feel like a foreigner in a foreign land here, which is to say that I'm neither familiar with the creation of K, nor am I really familiar enough with current procedures under the PCAOB. But I'm understanding the following, I think. When Appendix K was adopted, members of the SECPS were U.S. public accounting firms and not their international affiliates. So if we pick the Chilean firm, for example, and with apologies, Bob, apparently we're going to continue to pick on your office in Bogota, Chile. So at that point, there would be a reason to, from the SECPS's view, to bring this in as a way of assisting in the regulation, effectively, of an audit that was being conducted by a different firm in a different company that was part of the umbrella organization of one of the other major international accounting firms. My understanding now, though, is that that firm in Chile is a registered public accounting firm with the PCAOB currently, right? And so, therefore, it's required to comply with all of the regulations as a public accounting firm on its own right. And so, frankly, I'm having a hard time understanding why there's any need for this at all anymore under any circumstances, regardless of whether we're talking about IFRS or not. So I guess I apologize. I'm leaving you with a question rather than a comment.
Well, we'll allow some of the other SAG members to respond to the questions, some of the questions that Dick has raised. Damon Silvers?
Well, before I respond, maybe you can answer. Maybe I'll rephrase Dick's question. Is it the case today that if a foreign firm, whether or not an affiliate of a U.S. firm, is the auditor of a foreign private issuer's financial statements, which then, assuming these changes at the SEC occur, which then are filed without GAAP reconciliation in the United States, in that arrangement today, is the PCAOB in a position to assert its full authority? Inspection authority and enforcement authority in relation to that foreign firm? And two, is it your view that the PCAOB, I'm asking the PCAOB staff, is it your view that the PCAOB has the resources currently to do that with the foreign firms that could be playing that role in that context, if it's true that you actually have the full authority that you would have vis-a-vis a U.S. firm? Anybody answer?
You want me to help you out? They don't want to. I'll respond for them.
I was just going to say, I'm not sure
I understand why the question can't be answered by the PCAOB itself.
Well, I'm just saying I'm not really probably in the best position to respond to the question given my responsibilities. Kayla Gillen perhaps would like to.
I'm going to give it a shot. Hey, if I'm wrong, somebody at their table tell me. Yes, we have jurisdiction over every account who issues a report for a U.S. Traded company, and they have to follow PCAOB's auditing standards. The resource question is much more difficult, and it has to do with, and I think we've talked about this, our ability to engage. We have releases talking about how we engage with the home country regulators and determine the level of reliance and interaction that we need. So it is a country-by-country specific analysis as to our resource issue on the inspections side. But, yes, we're completely under our jurisdiction. Correct me if I'm wrong, someone.
I mean, my comment about this, which I'm not at all surprised by that answer, my comment about this is that so long as there are resource constraints here, that it's helpful to investors to engage the resources of the home of the parent firm, more or less, in this process. And that while it's true that the language in Appendix K that relates directly to the reconciliation process will be superfluous once there is no reconciliation process, that the language that relates, as the handout states, to ensuring the knowledge of the audit, the engagement teams, the engagement team's familiarity with and understanding of the applicable U.S. Independent standards, right, and auditing standards, is quite relevant. And in a world in which the board is resource constrained, having the involvement of the parent firm in policing that seems like something helpful and ought to be retained.
Joe Carcello.
Yeah, I'm going to piggyback on what Damon said. I didn't know where he was going to go, but I think that's essentially the issue. And with Kaler's response, I think where I would go with that is that to the extent that the board makes a country-by-country specific decision as to rely on regulators there as to how robust their inspection process is, that's essentially what we have in place. But to the extent that there are certain countries where the inspection process is not as robust, it would seem to me that there's an issue for the board to be doing even more inspections there than they are in the U.S., and there's a question of whether the resources are there to do that. There's also an issue from the perspectives of the firms, which is Appendix K. Now, I heard either Sam or Bob, I forget which one, said they're not proposing to get away from the inspection of their affiliates. They're just trying to get away from the review of what will not even be there anymore, a reconciliation that'll be gone. But I would argue, and I'd be curious to have the firm people here respond to this, I would argue that the inspection process, the internal firm inspection process for foreign affiliates should be even more aggressive and more robust than it is in the United States for two reasons. In the United States, you have private securities litigation that acts as a disciplining mechanism. In some foreign countries, you don't have that. Secondly, in the United States, if you had an extremely rogue auditor, the United States Department of Justice gets interested. If you have an extremely rogue auditor affiliated with your firm in Chile, Bob, then you have to rely on extraterritorial reach of the U.S. criminal laws to get at that person. So I would say the risk is greater when we rely on Deloitte Chile than when we rely on Deloitte U.S., and I'd be curious to hear the firms talk about the relative intensity of internal inspections in these foreign affiliates vis-a-vis what happens in the United States.
Bob Kippers?
Okay. Our Chilean firm actually has been inspected by the PCAOB. I don't know why I picked them. I do think there's a couple things that, and I don't know whether this is good or bad. This Appendix K and the whole dynamic around it at its inception was essentially what some might call a gatekeeper provision. This is on the theory that, you know, the U.S. firm is the gatekeeper to the U.S. market, and, you know, we are not a parent of any foreign affiliated member firm in no way, shape, or form. However, I am a little jealous of the reputation of the U.S. firm and our relationships with the SEC and the other regulators. So, you know, it is in my interest to see the best performance possible with respect to any of our foreign affiliates that serve clients in their country that then come into the U.S. capital markets. You know, whether or not in a world where we now have PCAOB direct inspection, we do have, in our case, I think most of the networks do, a firm-on-firm global inspection that's administered by our umbrella organization. And we also have adopted, essentially within our firm, without any, this isn't necessarily universal, but we have a credentialing program that anybody who works on a U.S. filer, whether it be a subsidiary of a U.S. company or a foreign filer in their own right, has to be credentialed by the global organization as in terms of their knowledge of U.S. GAAP, GAS independence requirements. None of that was there in 1999, all of that has changed. I think the most, I think, you know, Dick's point, and he was absolutely right, the fact that those firms have direct registration and the PCAOB has both authority and responsibility does change it. I mean, if it's viewed as, if the firms are being viewed as trying to get out of something, I don't think that's the case. I think we're suggesting that in the new world, it's going to be far less meaningful than where it's been in the last 8 or 9 years, and we should really seriously rethink the necessity of it. But I think we also shouldn't overplay the efficacy and importance of Appendix K. I think it has caught some things, absolutely, but I don't think it's a panacea in any way. I think the other things I mentioned are much more important to enhancing quality.
Ben Coleman?
I think Bob covered it. You know, we've also been inspected in Chile, as an example, just to give a sense of it. I just wanted to make a couple points that maybe just being, I know Appendix K is tough for a lot of people in the room. We've lived through it. It's a little bit for the foreign private issuers. I mean, Appendix K, remember, when you read Appendix K in 2.2, it focuses on the differences between the auditing standards in your local country and the U.S. And Sam made the point with respect to what's accepted in the states, right? So when you get into this, you just, to the point that was made by Cynthia, I mean, no matter what, it needs to be updated because the world is different today than it was then. I mean, it's just a simple fact. And I think that fact absolutely needs to be dealt with. The other thing when you're talking about resources that I think we have to keep in mind is, if anybody, and I don't have the latest analysis, but the number of foreign private issuers that are registered in the United States has decreased recently. And I think that model cannot be not understood as you're thinking about Appendix K, because it happens to be a fact. Going around, are procedures similar to what both Bob and Sam said? When you think about the auditing, and so we'll leave the accounting off, when you think about the auditing and the independence, the base for what we have here are the international standards and then added to them. So both for independence and with respect to auditing, we've already gone there on a global basis. All right? That's not where we were back in 1999. So therefore, when the inspectors come in, both in the local country and here in the States, what they're doing is very different than what they would have done in 1999. In addition, when they look at our system of internal controls and procedures, similarly, they're going to look at it, including our inspection process, all right, and the results of our inspection process on a global basis, which also includes what Bob talked about with respect to the efficacy of the people's knowledge with respect to both U.S. GAAP and the auditing and independent standards. But they are global standards, and it is run that way now, very different than it was back in 1999. So there is a cost-benefit ratio of this. I mean, by all means, I mean, last thing we want to do is do work that at an additional cost. It is a third check, right? And there are other protections for investors that have been now put in place. So really what you have is all those other things have been put in place and something that's never really been updated that's an incremental cost that I think you could challenge the benefit on the non-accounting side. When you go to the efficacy of the accounting and U.S. GAAP is still utilized, that really has continued value, and it had the value from 1999 all the way to today of really, particularly when organizations were adopting IFRS and the challenge of, well, why is that a reconciling item from U.S. GAAP back to IFRS? It was a very, very valuable discipline over the last couple of years.
David Becker.
I think it's not true that auditors outside the United States can't be sued for improper audits of foreign private issuers. One can get jurisdiction over them, and I would think that folks who represent shareholders in this type of litigation have the incentive to do that. I can tell you we do a lot of work for lots of foreign private issuers, and I can tell you that the local audit firms, and not just their U.S. partners in the network are quite conscious of threats of both enforcement activity and private litigation in the United States, particularly in those places where foreign private issuers are principally located, being Canada, Israel, United Kingdom, Germany. And so, to the extent the concern is that there are a whole bunch of foreign auditors out there not auditing with the same degree of anxiety that U.S. auditors audit, I just don't think it's true.
Sam Renzilla?
Well, I don't believe our firm in Chile has been inspected, and I'm sure they're feeling very left out. We too have a credentialing system in our global organization for U.S. GAAP, similar to what Bob described, and I think similar to what most of the large firms have. But before you can get on a particular engagement, and we code them by A, B's, and C's based on the nature of the engagement and the risk assessment around the engagement, you know, there are certain training and experience requirements you have to have met. Similarly, in the to maybe front run where we're headed a little bit later, we have the same exact credentialing system here in the United States for IFRS. So if you're asked to do to participate on an audit of a European company, gets designated a risk assessment, and you have to have certain training and experience requirements to function as the partner or the manager on that account, even though you may not be necessarily signing any auditor's reports other than within the global organization. So, again, I think those are things, as Bob mentioned, especially on the U.S. GAAP side, those are new since 1999. To answer Joe's question about inspections, as it relates to foreign private issuers, we have a separate inspection system that is run by the International Risk Management Group and includes bringing in inspectors that have U.S. GAAP expertise, which primarily, not primarily, but to some great degree, is people coming from the U.S. to do specifically a review of a foreign private issuer to comply with this item B in Appendix K. So I don't know if it's more rigorous or not, but it's special. It's looked after by our international organization, but draws heavily on U.S. resources in order to accomplish it. And my guess is it has maybe a tighter deadline with respect to how often a company or a partner who functions in that role might be inspected as it relates to a foreign private issuer.
Lynn Turner.
When Appendix K was originally done, we'd actually seen, and what really drove us to go back to the practice section at the time on it, was we'd actually seen a large telecom down in South America come in and list with us, and the financial statements said they've been audited in accordance with U.S. GAAP and U.S. auditing standards, and yet they didn't appear to even be remotely close. And we called up the national office of Sam's firm at the time and found out they weren't even aware of it, weren't even aware of the filing, hadn't ever seen it. And as a result, then that telecom had to go back through a major restatement. It took a lot of time on the firm's part. When the national office did get involved, they did a great job and got things where they needed to be. But nonetheless, something had come in and could have very well gone through the cracks that would have cost investors a very, very serious problem, because it's a large telecom getting privatized. And so we went back to the practice section. We said, let's put something in place so we know there's a gatekeeper, so the SEC doesn't have to be the gatekeeper on each one of these. And the firms agreed to do that and came up with a kind of a give and take on the negotiations and came up with K. So Appendix K was designed to be put in place to make sure that there was someone in the firm that was gatekeeping these and making sure that they were getting done and done right. And as that went in place, there was no question in the national offices of the firm, they started doing a much better job of putting things in place, notwithstanding the fact we still continued. I actually think K does give investors in the United States some assurance that whoever's auditing, and even if they're in IFRS, it's still supposed to be done in accordance with U.S. auditing standards. And there has been problems at the Commission from time to time with the quality of audits being done in accordance with those standards. And certainly we've seen cases led by probably Learnout and Houseby and Parmalat and others where there's been problems with the auditing standards. We've also seen time and time again some questions raised. It's an ongoing battle as to whether or not those firms are really complying with the independent standards over here. And the only way you really probably get that, I've talked to people in the national offices, several of the firms that deal with the independence issues, and they tell me they still have to knock their head against the wall trying to ensure independence today. And then you say, well, the audits are all being done okay over there. But here just a year ago, we had the Japan regulator go in and totally shut down one of the big four firms. Apparently, they thought it was bad enough that they wiped out a firm. So in light of that, I'd have serious questions as to whether or not you really are getting those that quality. I do have a lot of trust in the four guys in their offices sitting around the table here, but I'm not sure that I'd turn around, and especially in light of what we saw in Japan, would turn that over to some foreign office. And certainly the firms themselves have had concerns because they've all set up offices in London or wherever where they send some very talented people from here in the U.S. Sam sent Mary Tokar and the likes over there just to help police this stuff. And you talk to those people, and they'll tell you they beat their heads against the wall trying to make sure that things get done. So you take that gatekeeping, that safeguard out of the system and remove Appendix K, then you open it back up, I think, to what we've had in the past. And I think what the PCAOB really needs to focus on is, do you have a real functioning, honest-to-goodness quality control system in place that ensures those international audits are coming in here and getting done right? And it's not so much Appendix K or whatever as it is, do you have that quality control built in someplace that ensures that you can hold those people accountable to? And I'd say, especially in light of what we saw in Japan, you haven't got that yet.
Let's continue our discussion with the next question on Appendix K. If the SEC were to remove the U.S. GAAP reconciliation requirement for those foreign private issuers that currently prepare their financial statements in accordance with the International Financial Reporting Standards, what changes, if any, would be needed for Appendix K? Bob Kippers?
Greg, sorry, I was just come back on Lynn's point. It's related, though. Lynn, nobody said it was easy. To your points. But I think one of the worries is that, you know, be careful not to over rely on Appendix K as a particularly effective way to enhance quality. In our firm, at least, anybody coming into the U.S. market to raise money or have files a 10K that they think will then be used in, you know, shelf type, you know, used in a future filing for exchange offer or whatever. That goes through our National Office SEC group with a very, very detailed review of the filing. And, of course, that today includes the reconciliation. If I had to say, would I rather do that or do Appendix K, I actually feel that our people that
you know, for a living all day long, look at U.S. filings and look at foreign filings are probably more effective in many ways than Appendix K. The only difference is, in part, that Appendix K requires a conversation with the engagement team around certain things. But, you know, I'm just suggesting that, you know, we've probably spent more time than it deserves, but that I'm just not convinced it's still necessary, but, I mean, this is not a do-or-die issue for the firms. We're just trying to look at in totality of all the changes that have come, and, you know, you'll have to take all the input you're getting and decide what to do with that because it is now part of your transitional standards.
Other comments? Well, due to some time constraints, let's move ahead to the next question. The last question in this on this particular topic, what auditing issues might arise if the SEC removed the U.S. GAAP reconciliation requirement for those foreign private issuers that prepared those financial statements in accordance with the international standards? What would any other amendments or additions to the PCAOB standards be necessary? Galen Hansen?
I've been sort of sandbagging a little bit. I want to express some dissent, maybe some contrarian opinion on this entire area, and I've kind of been waiting until these questions came up. I ended up responding to the SEC's proposal on removing the reconciliation as well as really the concept release that they put out. And yeah, you know, it's been said here earlier that a compelling case can be made for a single set of standards. And I think that's true if that were, in fact, the case. And I think, and I'll go through this in some of my comments, I think there are more than one set of IFRS standards. And I'm not so much opposed to a single set of standards right now as opposed to kind of the timing of what this is all about. And I think convergence is the way to go, at least in the interim, and replacement of our standards is definitely not the way to go. Something said about roadmaps, and I'm reminded of, Lewis Carroll's story where Alice is talking to the Cheshire Cat, and she's looking for direction, and the cat responds, well, that depends a good deal on where you want to go. And then she responds, so long as I get somewhere. And I'm not sure that we know, really, at this point, where we're trying to go with all of this. The United States has always been a leader in the financial reporting area. And it seems like that has been kind of reversed now, where we're starting to become the follower. We have a premier capital market, U.S. GAAP. GAS, whether it's PCOB or GAS standards, they are the gold standard. I can tell you as a state board member, we get a lot of people that apply to become CPAs that aren't even citizens of this country. And they come in and they take the CPA exam, and that is the credential that they use in their country. They never intend to come to the United States to practice, but that's how well recognized our standards are. But I want to share with you some of my reservations about this entire area. One of the things that I'm concerned with is that the IASB has no direct regulatory oversight, unlike the SEC in this country that has oversight with the FASB. I think there's questions about the financial independence of the IASB. I think their funding is uncertain. It comes from a small number of private donors, some of the large firms, some large corporations, governmental bodies. I think there's questions about their political independence. The pure IFRS standards have to go through an endorsement process. And just to illustrate that, in the New York Times this morning, there was an article in the business section that I thought I would share with you. There's a new chair, Gerrit Zalm, from Netherlands, been appointed as the chair of the foundation of the IASB that is the governing body. And just a couple quick quotes out of here. They've come under considerable pressure in Europe from some politicians who think the board should be more accountable to governments and should pay more attention to their opinions in setting accounting standards. International accounting standards are gaining acceptance in many countries in the world, although in some cases governments have ordered exceptions. For example, the European Commission, acting at the behest of French banks, decided that European countries or companies could ignore part of one standard dealing with derivatives and said that the Standards Board should find a way to work out a compromise that should satisfy the banks. Well, is that where we really want to go? As I said, there's a lot of different versions of IFRS. I think it's an illusion to say that there is just a single IFRS. Our U.S. GAAP has grown up in an environment of the U.S. legal system, as well as the other standards that we deal with, like independence and ethics. And that isn't the case with IFRS. And we have a lot of years of experience behind us in dealing with U.S. GAAP, as opposed to, I mean, companies have really been only filing IFRS for the last, since 2005, as I understand it. Aside from all of that, there's also the implementation aspect of dealing with IFRS. We maybe assume that other people around the world have our same training, educational standards, and that isn't necessarily the case. In a good part of the world, the minimum requirement to enter our profession is more based on an apprenticeship concept. And so I think what I've tried to articulate anyway is that I think there's another side of this issue at some level that really needs to be examined. And I feel like we've kind of committed ourselves to this whole proposition of going down this path. And I respectfully just wanted to voice that opinion today.
Thanks, Gail. Let me just butt in here for a second. It may be sometimes hard to divide the accounting issues from the auditing issues, and just want to make sure that we can appreciate what you believe the auditing implications are with regard to these issues as we continue this discussion. Since I've interrupted the conversation, I just want to point out that unfortunately several of our colleagues from the SEC won't be able to join us this afternoon. Conrad and John and Julie will be have to depart around lunchtime. And so I just wanted to pause for a moment just to recognize that and see, Conrad, if you or your colleagues had any input you wanted to
mention. Well, thank you, Ray. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning from all of us at the SEC. You've had excellent discussion on the XBRL and the I4US and some of the implications are in the future. I just want to touch on the XBRL because John mentioned it, and I just want to add a footnote to it, if I may. We at the SEC think the XBRL is a technology tool of interactive data, and as a result, we have created a new office of interactive disclosure within the SEC because we feel very strongly that for the investor, for the capital markets in the United States and throughout the world, XBRL is really a very important tool. David Blaskoski is the new director. He comes from S&P, where he had been there for about 10, 12 years. He'll eventually have a full-time staff of 12 people scattered throughout the SEC to help the user, the preparer, and the investor in various segments of the SEC world to help them move on with the XBRL project. So right now we have four full-time people devoted to XBRL within the SEC, and that will be expanded in a couple months as we move forward. The XBRL has been fully developed as of September 24th, approximately 16,000 taxonomies across 10 various industries. We had a lot of help from the volunteers and the major firms, and FASB in particular is now reviewing that in accordance with GAAP on the taxonomies, and we at the SEC will be doing the same thing to ensure that the taxonomy is GAAP where it has to be. So that's kind of it on the XBRL. The other point on the I for us is that, as you know, we have the proposing release and the concept release. They're not exactly related. They may be somewhat related. We've received over 125 comment letters on the proposing release, and we're analyzing, reviewing, and summarizing those to see where we're going with that. I really think that if we need to keep the U.S. capital markets very competitive. The economy in the world has changed in the last 5 years, 10 years, dramatically. There are over 50 capital markets throughout the world that compete with our markets. And part of this relates to international accounting, international rules of independence, international auditing. So my thinking is, you know, the convergence of international, we at the SEC would like to see one gold standard someday that everybody can rely upon within the world economy. That's going to be a long ways off, but we're working towards that goal. I also believe personally that, and you mentioned it this morning somewhat, a couple times, that the auditing world has to be converged someday, the auditing standards. It would be a much difficult process than those of the accounting standards. And then the third part I see that as I become involved with our review of our independent rules at the SEC and elsewhere, that worldwide convergence of independent rules needs to be done. There are just too many players that the practitioner cannot comply with and understand. So those are some of my thoughts that I have shared with you this morning. John?
You covered it.
Good morning. I don't often get to attend, so I'll take the opportunity since Tom invited. I'll just relay one observation with respect to the foreign issuer proposal, and that is sometimes I think people have the impression that what the effect of this is to the SEC requiring something or other or eliminating the requirement of something for other. I mean, at its core, we give foreign issuers right now two choices for how to report, either prepare statements in U.S. GAAP, which, you know, Bob Kipper's alluded to some of his clients doing that, or choice number two is, which is kind of also maybe somewhat of an American-type choice, style choice, but, you know, reconcile home country statements to U.S. GAAP. And what we're proposing to do, the commission proposing to do, is add a third choice to the menu, if you will, which is, you know, allow I4S as published by the ISB financial statements. But we've observed that some of our foreign issuers today who are in capital markets at home that have moved to IFRS, and ostensibly they have IFRS statements in their back pocket, don't file them with us. They continue to take choice one off our menu, existing menu, and file U.S. GAAP financial statements. So I think the interesting question will be, if the commission were to move ahead, what will the market reaction be to the third choice being available? And also, that third choice doesn't say anything about the process and procedures that companies or auditors should use to make sure that the IFRS financial statements would be done well. So sometimes I hear, well, you know, if you remove the reconciliation requirement implicitly by adding the third choice, you know, the quality of the statements that are filed will be worse. And I try to diagram that and say, well, the quality is going to be in the hands of those preparing and auditing them. And if there are procedures that they think are appropriate to make them as high quality as they need to be, why would those procedures all go out the window, you know, just under choice three versus choice two? I mean, if, for example, looking at what U.S. GAAP would call for in the accounting in a certain area to triage and get a sense of whether the IFRS accounting makes sense or is done properly, if that's the most efficient way for a company or an auditor to triage it, why wouldn't they continue for their own internal purposes to do it? So I think one thing just to keep in mind is that it's adding a choice for issuers, and you can debate, and the comment letters came in and certainly gave us insight on whether it would be wise to add such a choice, but it is a choice, and then whether the market takes that choice, is a separate question, as opposed to sometimes it's viewed as the SEC is driving a particular, is driving people to that third alternative. I think whether a company goes to that third alternative, is going to be a function of whether they think their investors understand IFRS or are willing to learn IFRS or would not, require a premium in such that, it wouldn't be worth it anymore. So I just think that's sort of maybe more the economic context of this issue, and it's probably hopefully a useful backdrop to then considering some of the implementation matters like you've discussed today.
Thank you, Con and Julie, for your comments. Joe Carcello?
I have a couple of things to say. First, I want to thank Galen for his extremely articulate explanation of his concerns. I would encourage everyone in this room to read his comment letter. I think it is one of the best I've read a lot of these comment letters. I think it's one of the best comment letters I've read. And one of the things that he points out in his comment letter is that for the U.S., adopting IFRS would be tantamount to handing foreign parliaments a significant political role in our standard-setting process. I really wonder, when the American public finds this out, how happy they're going to be to turn over the safety of their 401k plans over to the European Union. I think you should send this comment letter to some of the people who are running for president. Julie talks about choices exist, and all the SEC would be doing here is providing choices. My argument back, Julie, would be choices exist in the absence of a regulator. Regulators exist to narrow choices, not to create choices. And as I told John last night, I'm going to pick on him so he doesn't feel unloved, John gave a speech to the PLI conference in New York on May 2nd. And essentially John's argument is he talks about if U.S. companies could choose between U.S. GAAP and IFRS, John stated that, and now I quote, market forces may well be the driver leading companies to select one accounting system over another, end of quote. Market forces may work if a firm's owners, stockholders, truly control the corporation, as evidenced by their ability to meaningfully elect individuals as directors who will represent their interest. Unfortunately, the prospects of meaningful shareholder proxy access looks bleak at the SEC, given the departure of Campos and the forthcoming departure of Nazareth. Without meaningful shareholder access, too many boards defer to top management preferences, and too many management teams run the corporation for their own benefit. And to paraphrase Herb Simon, they only seek to satisfy in terms of corporate performance. Given this environment, a true market test does not exist. Rather, we have a rigged market, one where the accounting principles selected might be chosen to maximize management flexibility in managing income. And, Tom, I'll tie this into auditing. What is the auditing issue here? If the SEC does allow U.S. corporations to choose U.S. GAAP or IFRS, I would suggest that those that choose IFRS may be choosing IFRS because it provides greater flexibility in the ability to manage income, which in my view poses higher risk to audit quality and financial reporting quality.
Julie Earhart?
Sorry, I didn't turn my card up. Just one comment just to clarify. When I said the effect of, or the, the essence of the proposal is to add a choice, but I agree a job of regulators to limit choices so we have the right level of quality, but I would say it's to add a choice under the assumption, and people can dispute the judgment, but under the assumption that the choice you're adding meets a minimum level of acceptability. Now, I absolutely take the points, and that's why the proposal goes out, that people may say, you're screwed up because the choice you've added doesn't meet the minimum level of acceptability, and ergo, you shouldn't do it. But my comments weren't to imply that a regulator should add choices ad nauseum. It, it's assuming it's within, you know, the acceptable range. So, but I take the point. People may think it's not within the acceptable range. That's the flaw. That's certainly a point that people feel free to, you know, have that point of view.
Bob Kippers, you'll have the final comment before we take a break for lunch.
Okay, I know we're up against lunch, but to answer your questions about amendments that might be needed to your standards, there are a few areas that would, maybe this is obvious and a little too technical, but the reporting standards need some repairs and maintenance because they are presuppose U.S. GAAP. And so you'd have to make certain changes, including AU 534 and certain sections. I mean, but beyond the reporting standards, just want to remind people that IFRS has disclosure guidance for going concern, which U.S. GAAP does not. If, as might be expected, the FASB adds that to U.S. GAAP, then the standard on going concern would have to be rethought because that has like a 1 year. IFRS is more flexible than the 1 year, and that might cause you to have to reconsider something around going concern. But I think the biggest issue with auditing standards is the one I don't know have a solution for, and that's the extent that audit reports in many places under your standards refer to financial statements prepared in accordance with IFRS, you know, which version? You know, as promulgated, EU version, EU version as applied in Spain. I don't know. I'm just saying that the confusion around a reference to IFRS when we do have this so-called jurisdictional difference, I think could lead to potential user confusion about what that audit report is really attesting to.
Okay, thank you. We will now break for lunch and resume this discussion at 1 o'clock. There is lunch for the members of the SAG, the official observers, and PCAOB staff upstairs. Thank you.